And good evening and welcome to Bird Calls from the Knoll Foundation Studios here at Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. We invite you to call in with your questions about our feathered friends tonight and the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he is ready to answer your questions about birds and birding tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he has been an avid bird watcher for over 30 years. He is also the first author of the book, Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University, and he has authored over 80 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife, Julie, and their two children live in East Texas. Cliff, thanks for joining us again this month.
Hey, good evening, Bill.
And once again, we invite everybody to call in with your questions tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding birds in our avian world are welcome, and you can also send emails with pictures and photos and sound if you would like to my address. That's wbeckett@lsus.edu. wbeckett, two T's on Beckett, at lsus.edu. Well, Cliff, at the end of last month's program, as usual, you gave us a conservation tip, and would you like to recap that for us?
Yeah, so last month we talked about how we should let others know around us that we care about local wildlife, and so I really wanted to make sure people know that when they're traveling and they're going fishing or hiking or bird watching or hunting or camping or anything in the outdoors, and you're appreciating local natural areas like a nearby park or a river, a refuge, or a beach, to let the locals in that area know why you're there, that you're an ecotourist, that you're spending money, precious dollars in their community because you see the value of that natural area in their immediate area. And also the locals can then see the importance of investing in those parks and their natural areas, so future tourists will keep coming. So it's this big circle that you have to be part of to make sure that everyone knows that, hey, people do love that park over there, or they love that nature area, or that remote, you know, thick woods, wooded area, and why. And then people start protecting it because money talks. If we don't protect these areas, they'll get lost to some other interest group. And bird watching and hunting and other outdoor exercises are big business. So, for example, hunting in my state has an overall economic impact of $3.6 billion with a B dollars annually, and bird watching about $13.8 billion. So these are big dollars, and we have to make sure we retain some of these natural areas so we can keep doing these outdoor things. And those of you that have been around a while have seen a lot of these wild places go away. And so we need to make sure we protect these areas. And one way to do it is to tell people that you appreciate wildlife and why, and that you're when you're traveling, tell your hotel manager, tell the restaurant manager. If you see folks also birding there and they're local, let them know that, hey, we traveled from far away to come here, and this place is special to us as well as it is to you. So that really helps to protect these wild places.
If you don't tell them you love it, then they may not love it with you.
That's right.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding birds and birding are welcome. And this month we have a profile species, as we do each month. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, tonight we're going to profile our first gull, the ring-billed gull. And let's listen to its wheezy calls and cries here. The, the ring-billed gull. We often use the word seagull, which is an informal way of referring to any species that belongs to the family Laridae, the gulls. There isn't a single species officially known as the seagull. Instead, it's a colloquial name for any member of the gull family. The ring-billed gull is predominantly found across North America and is one of the most common and widespread of the white-headed gulls, plus it occurs inland across the entire Red River Radio listening area during the winter months. During the summer months, this species nests to our north in prairies and lakes of the Midwest, Great Lakes, and Canada. It can be seen on our area lakes and rivers, or even parking lots in search of scraps. They also occur on the nearby Gulf coastline. Anglers obviously encounter these and other gulls the most. There are over 20 species of gulls found across the U.S., and many look similar, creating major identification challenges for birders. I, for one, have a tough time especially differentiating immature plumage gulls. In the ring-billed gull, the sexes are alike, and the best field mark is the black ring around the bill found in most age classes of this gull. The adult has yellow legs, a white head, sometimes with dark fleckings in winter, and a pale gray back with black wingtips. Speaking of black wingtips, did you know that most white water birds have black wingtips which protect against wear and tear? That black pigment, or melanin, provides a protective coating in case the wingtips of these water birds hit the surface of the water. So to see a photo of a ring-billed gull snapped by our very own James Childress of Lufkin, please go to the Red River Radio website and look up the bird calls page for tonight's episode.
And it is a beautiful photo. I want to know how he gets the birds to pose.
Yeah.
Because they just won't do that for me.
He's getting better, and I'll tell you, he's actually doing crazy stuff like laying on the ground to get a bird's eye view of a bird on the ground, and even getting in the water. Sometimes without waders on or waterproof clothing, he and another buddy of his are wading through water to get pictures of ducks, and so that way it gets a really good image of the duck right just a few inches above the water. So it's a neat effect, and a lot of wildlife photographers are doing that. You know, they're keeping their distance. That's the main right. thing to think about is keep your distance. And if you don't keep your distance, your target is going to fly away. It's really that simple when we're talking about especially ducks in winter out on a pond or lake. But it's pretty cool to see how folks are getting some of these photos. And then the equipment now, my goodness, it's just amazing to see what images people are taking. And when I first started in this, it was all
film,
print film, yeah. and slide and ektachrome and Kodachrome, and you know, you never knew if you took 15 pictures if you were hoping one would come out. Now those guys can just rattle off 120 pictures, and certainly one of those is going to come out pretty good.
Well, I know I was recently down along Clyde Fant, and there's some flooding down there, so the normal small little ponds have grown big, and there was a whole flock. This was 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago. An entire flock, must have been 50 to 100 great egrets down there, oh. just waiting. They're walking along this wooden bridge. I got some great shots Neat. With them all lined up. I mean, some really beautiful shots yeah. during the daytime, but nothing quite as detailed as he's getting. He must have a huge lens
on He does. He does. And he works out, and I think it helps because I can't imagine what it's like holding that gigantic lens all the time.
Yeah, I gotta get me one of those. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. But first, we have an email question that was sent in, and this was about some damage to a tree, I believe, and you have the email there. Could you
yes.
go ahead and tell us about this?
So this person sent pictures of a tree, a close-up of a tree with a lot of excavations on it. It's a live tree, and there's various sizes of holes. Some are kind of square, some are rectangular, some are circular. It looks kind of like if someone took a machine gun and just, you know, started putting bullets in the tree. But there's a little woodpecker that's doing this. It's called the yellow-bellied sapsucker. And if you were called a sapsucker back in school, there really is a bird called a sapsucker. you know, you might have been called cuckoo or loon. There really are cuckoos and loons. So the yellow-bellied sapsucker, he's a woodpecker relative, and he doesn't kill the tree. He is merely injuring the tree, and the response of the tree is to ooze sweet sap. And just like we would put a, we'd have a little bit of blood that would dry over a boo-boo on our arm and would create a scab. Well, that's what this sap is going to do, but instead he comes along, or she, and comes along and eats that sweet sap and any insects that are attracted to that sweet sap. He or she will also get a trapped insect and consume that as well. So the tree is not girdled. In the picture, you can see that. And what's really ironic is I took a picture not 2 weeks ago in my yard of our American holly. That's a big one, and it's got fresh sapsucker sap wells on this tree as well in my yard. And I can get 10 feet from the bird. So yellow-bellied sapsuckers, they're not killing the tree. They're coming along and repeatedly eating the sap, and that way they can keep getting that nourishment. And the interesting thing is that bird is not here in the warmer months, so they're only here in the cooler months. They'll leave by early May. So if you have a sapsucker tree, enjoy the bird, and don't worry about the tree. It's not going to girdle it. It's not going to kill the tree.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have three callers online, Ethel and Oliver. Please stay with us. We've got to get to Susie first from Nacogdoches. Susie, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Yes, sir. About 2 weeks ago, what was thought to be a baby hummingbird was on my mother-in-law's back porch, and she said the little bill was about half an inch long, and we were wondering if it had just blown off course or what.
Okay, tell me again the approximate date. What month are we talking about?
2 weeks ago, so that would have been about the latter part of January or first of February.
Okay, well, there aren't any babies around this time of the year. You know, baby implies that it just came out of the nest, and
that's what I told her.
Yep. So that doesn't happen after about June or July in our area. So there are no babies, and actually there shouldn't be any hummingbirds, period, in our area. So I'm intrigued, but when you say a half inch long bill, that doesn't sound right either.
I know. That's what I was.
Yep. So I think we've gone down the wrong rabbit trail with the word hummingbird. It is probably a bird, right? It's got feathers, but it is not a hummingbird.
Thank you. Yep. I didn't see it for myself, but just wanted to make sure. Thank you so much.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'd like to see a picture of it if you.
Absolutely.
It's too late.
Oh, is it too late? Okay.
I already asked her.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we have lines open right now. And Ethel is still on hold. Please stay with us. We've got Oliver next from Boyce. First, I have a question. Do yellow-belly sapsuckers have a favorite kind of tree that they like?
Well, they like a lot of our fruit trees and anything young oaks. Usually the younger the tree, the better. Those trees are usually more vigorous, but it doesn't mean exclusively. I've seen plenty of large old trees too. I've seen pine. I've seen every kind of hardwood, but I think that a lot of our non-native fruit trees are really preferred. But again, I've seen a lot of young oaks that are native. So I don't think there's one specific tree. It's a variety pack.
And it's interesting when you say pine because they get turpentine from pine sap.
Yeah,
so
but
it's
they,
not exactly a sweet, you
no,
know, kind of a
but
sap.
That would be an example of them eating the insect trapped in the sap and maybe not taste. They're not eating that resin, that sap, but certainly the insects stuck in it. Yeah.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist. Ethel, please stay with us. We're going to Oliver next. Oliver, you're on with Cliff. What's your question tonight? Oh, I'm sorry. Maybe I've gone to Ethel. I'm sorry. Ethel, Oliver, please stay with us. Ethel, you're online with Cliff.
Thank you so very much for taking my call.
Yeah, where are you calling from, Ethel?
I'm calling from Leggett, Texas, and I'm listening to your program, and I really appreciate it. It's so informative.
Did you say Leggett as in Polk County?
Yeah.
All right.
I'm from Livingston, Texas.
Yes, I've got a good dear friend that lives in Leggett, and I have family in Goodrich. So I'm.
Okay.
Yep. So my dad was born in Polk County in 1937. So.
Right. What's the last name?
Shackleford is my last name, and our friends, my other family, the Nettles. Yep, and then the good dear friend, her last name is Johnston.
Yes,
that lives in Leggett.
Nettles.
Yep. So his uncle is also my cousin, and because Nettles married a Shackleford, and so those are cousins. So
I'm so privileged.
So we're practically friends, Ethel. Yeah. So what do you got tonight?
I've always been curious. I've seen what I call seagulls. Way away from the sea water area, and in parking lots, and I've always was curious.
Yeah.
Why would they congregate there when it's so far away from the
yeah.
water?
Yeah, and you can see that the closer you get to the Gulf Coast, like Lafayette in your state, in Louisiana, this state, and in my state, your state, and Leggett, in Texas, I can see them in Houston and Corpus. I see a lot of laughing gulls that come inland, 30, 40, 50 miles is not a chore for them. And they're coming after scraps. They're in our dumpsters. They're looking for stuff that we discard in parking lots. Ethel, I'm getting ahead of myself because our conservation tip ties into this exact topic. So if you can hold on for about 40 minutes at the end of the show, we're going to talk more about this whole phenomenon. But I think to answer your question, it's laughing gulls as you get closer to the coast, and they're after scraps of food in our dumpsters and French fries we drop in the to-go line, the drive-through window is what I'm looking for, and so they're looking for free handout is what they're doing. But farther inland, we talked about in the profiled species ring-billed gull. They'll come into my area of Nacogdoches. There I've seen lots of them in Tyler. I'll see them here in Shreveport, and so it's doing the same thing. They're moving into our area seasonally to congregate at scrap areas, and we'll talk more about that at the end about 6:55 p.m. plus or minus. So hopefully you can tune in, Ethel, and I appreciate your call, and go Leggett.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackleford, and we have lines open right now. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Well, I skipped over you, Oliver, but you're back with us. You're on with Cliff. What's your question?
All right, Cliff. This has always been my great time of the year. I have bird feeders right out in front of my house, and this last summer, the land in front of the house, probably about 15 acres, has been cleared. And my problem is that we have two hawks. Until about 4 or 5 days ago, I'd have 80 to 100 birds in my front yard. The hawks are catching the birds, eating the birds. They're making the birds run into the side of my house. I just picked up the fifth bird this morning that has died on my front porch. And I know you're not supposed to eradicate that type of a problem with firearm.
Yeah.
But I don't know what to do about it.
Okay.
It's upsetting me.
Yeah. And we deal with this a lot. Oliver, what part of the listening area are you calling from? Are you Shreveport?
I'm at Boyce, Louisiana, right out of Alexandria.
Okay, Boyce, Louisiana. Okay.
Right, central Louisiana.
Okay, what we recommend is if the feeders have created somewhat of a central station, like a
right.
bus station, and there's a lot of bustling movement of birds, and so if you have a problem with a couple of hawks camping out, and they're probably coopers and or sharp-shinned hawks, they're the dominant bird eaters that like to find out where people are feeding, the thing to do is to shut the feeder down and not encourage that central station effect. And so I know that might be hard.
That's what I have done. I just quit feeding them.
Yeah.
I have a cat that sits on top of a tower in front of my two double glass doors, and that's his entertainment every day.
Yeah.
We get up early before daylight and watching the birds come.
Right.
And he's there all day long now with nothing to watch, and I'm not able to enjoy the beauty of it, too.
And so another thing you mentioned, the birds are fleeing away from the hawks and hitting the windows or walls. So that tells me your feeders are too close to the house. So while they're shut down, you need to move them back farther so when they do flee, they don't hit these structures. But you have to also remember sharp-shinned and Cooper's hawks have to eat as well. They're going to get birds. That's all they eat. It's going to happen. And just because we see it, it shouldn't make you feel too bad. I mean, they're not going to just eat 10 and 20 birds a day. They're just going to take what they need and move on. But carnivorous birds have to eat too. So they're going to do it, and I know that it's tough to watch, but it is a National Geographic moment. But I'd say move your feeders away from the house because that's a waste of a bird if it's flying into the window or wall and dying that way.
Right.
Okay? All right, Oliver. All right. Well, good luck to you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Alrighty. Thank you, sir.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we have all lines open right now. You can get right in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And why don't we go ahead and encourage you folks out there, why don't you call in and tell us about your favorite species of birds and why they're memorable in your mind, what is going on in your life that was drawn to these birds, and we'd like to hear from you.
And tell us a little story about why it's your favorite bird. Yep.
800-552-8502 is the number to call. And while we're waiting for that, why are we seeing more hawks this time of year, especially along our roadways?
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So we're on the receiving end of a lot of wintering hawks. And the reason you see them along our highways, especially interstates, is that's where a lot of good cover is for their preferred prey. Things like hispid cotton rats and rabbits. And so any of these unmowed grassy areas are just covered in prey items, and the hawks know it, and they're sitting on poles and posts and wires looking down on these grassy areas. And if you look on the other side of the fence, it probably could be ag land or grazed really low, and you can't envision prey hiding in such a setting. There's no cover. So you don't have hispid cotton rats, and rabbits would never survive out in the open. So a lot of these rodents that are prey and these lagomorphs like rabbit, eastern cottontail, they're looking for dense cover. We have that along our roadsides, and then we are hosting a lot of these hawks. The dominant big one is red-tailed hawk that does breed here in small numbers, but we get a huge influx in the fall, and they winter with us, and they'll leave again in the spring. So it's because of the way we manage our properties, and highways typically have, the rights of way typically have good grass cover, and that's why raptors are there. I've heard people say, why do the hawks sit on the pole and watch the traffic go by? And hey, they're not looking at traffic. They're looking for a tasty meal in that thick grassy cover. So that kind of explains what's going on there.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding our avian world and birds is welcome. And I don't have a name yet, but we do have a caller online. We're just going to go ahead and take this. Hello, could you tell us your name and where you're from? And you're on with Cliff.
Something like that.
Hello? Well, they can't hear us yet. Can you hear me yet? Okay. Well, we're just going to leave them up. Hello from Wynn Parish. Can you hear us?
Or maybe not from one
parish.
Well,
obviously not. They're listening. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we did lose that caller. Can you tell us about something called eBirds?
Yeah, before I do, so callers should call back if we lose you,
yep.
If we get disconnected. Please call back. Okay, eBird, that's a good one. eBird was started, probably nearly 20 years ago, 15 for sure. It's the Cornell Lab of Ornithology started it, and it is a great resource for bird numbers. It's a bird database. And so the way it works, it's citizen scientists like you and me that want to tell others what we've seen. You go in, you tell them where you are and how long you've been there and what the date is and then what birds you're seeing. And it can be just in your backyard, and it might be four species, or it could be in migration and you go to Cameron Parish and you've got 113 species. So it's just a great platform where people should go to submit bird data. And if you're curious about what birds are in an area that you're going to, eBird is a really good database to mine, very easy to mine the data, M-I-N-E, like a gold miner, where you can ask questions and you know, query the data and figure out, okay, I'm going to this part of the U.S., what birds might I see? And you can kind of create this checklist of, well, here are the most common birds that have been reported for that area. So I encourage listeners to look up eBird, E-B-I-R-D. It's free, it's online, and it's a fantastic resource thanks to Cornell Lab.
All right, you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we went from a drought to three calls online. Gary and Elroy, please stay with us. We've got one caller ahead of you from Wynn Parish. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, you're on with Cliff. Can you tell us your name and what you're calling about?
I'm Lorraine, and I'm from Wynn Parish, and my question is about purple finches.
Okay.
We ordinarily, when our parents were living here, they had purple finches in mid-October to maybe early December, but we have had purple finches from December all the way. They haven't left us.
Yeah.
What's the matter?
Yeah.
Why are they doing this?
Well, they are overwintering with us, so we've had them at our feeder as well, and they've been a good addition to our winter bird feeding, and they'll stick around for several more weeks. So it's not unusual that they're still here because of dead of winter. So I think it would be more unusual if you had one in, say, April or May, but not right now. So it means keep putting out that black oil sunflower seed. It also means look for the lookalike house finch that looks very similar to a purple finch, but once you learn the two, you'll never make the mistake again of the miss ID. So the purple finch is the one that's only here in the cold months, and house finch is here year-round. So that's a good find, Lorraine, and you should enjoy it because we don't get purple finches at our feeders every year. It's something that's maybe, I don't know, every 5 or 8 years that I'll get one at my feeder. And then this long dry spell, and boom, there they are again. So they're not annual at most feeders. They are annual in our area. You can usually find them out in the woods. They're up in the sweet gum trees eating the sweet gum balls, the seeds in those balls. They're this time of the year, February, March, they're looking for fresh buds that are coming out on the trees, like on our elms. Their purple finches are going to stick around for a little while longer. So enjoy them while we have them, Lorraine. They're beautiful birds.
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
We've never had them in this number and to stay this long. And I was just wondering if we can blame this on climate change or something.
Yeah, no, we call this an invasion or an eruption year. An eruptive species is something like a purple finch that it depends on cone crop availability, food in other parts of the country. And sometimes when there is no food in the cupboard, it pushes them to Texas and Louisiana and far parts of the South. But when there's plenty of food available to the North, why come all the way down here? It's not a joyride to come all the way down here. It's a lot of effort, a lot of calories burned, a lot of obstacle, so they don't have to come here every year. But it's usually an eruptive species is based on cone crop availability. Red-breasted nuthatch is another good example. Evening grosbeak in other parts of the country, and used to be in our listening area, but boy, I've not heard of an evening grosbeak in my area in decades. I mean, it's just a hard bird to come by now. So enjoy those purple finches while you got them. Thanks, Lorraine.
Thank you.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. 800-552-8502. Gary from Lufkin, please stay with us. And we have Elroy coming up next from Texarkana. Elroy, you're on with Cliff. What's your question? Hello, Elroy. Please turn your radio down and go ahead and ask your question.
Hello?
Yes, you're on. Please turn your radio down. You'll get a horrible echo.
I'll write it down. Hello?
Hello, yep. Elroy. Go ahead.
I'm from Texarkana, Texas.
All yes. Right. You're on the correct side of the Texarkana line, then.
Yes, ma'am. Yes,
and,
sir.
And what's your question tonight, Elroy?
I want to know, Phil, if he knows about eagles.
Okay. Bald eagles? What would you like to know?
Bald eagles.
Yeah. Yeah, we have lots of bald eagles in the wintertime, and we have quite a few that stay and breed. Did you have anything specifically you wanted to ask?
Well, but down here in Texarkana on the river down here, we got these bald eagles flying around.
Yep, and I bet you didn't see that in the 60s, did you, or the 70s? So that's a bird that's really rebounded, and we're starting to see the benefit of protective measures to benefit this bird, and it's really exploded. So that's a bird that we didn't see much of in the 60s and 70s, and now things have turned around, and we're seeing a lot more bald eagles. So are you enjoying seeing them? Yeah. Are you enjoying seeing those bald eagles?
I love to see them.
Yeah, they're neat, and they're huge.
And, yeah, they are.
Yep, and it's neat to see the different age classes. It take about 5 years to get the full white head and tail. So when you see an all brown one sitting near it, that's a young bird that could be anywhere from, that year, born that year, to 4-something years old.
Well, can I ask you a question?
Yes, sir.
What year were you born?
1967.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I'm a youngster, right?
Yeah, pretty much. I'm an old man.
How about you, Elroy? What year were you born?
I was born in 1950.
All right. Well, you still got a long ways to go then.
Maybe.
Yeah. And if you keep enjoying bald eagles and other birds, it'll make you live longer. It'll drop your blood pressure.
Oh, yeah?
It does for me. It's very soothing to get out and do nature. So thanks for the call, Elroy.
All right. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We're going next to Gary from Lufkin. You're on with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Well, about the favorite bird.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I always enjoy the springtime when the robins come back. But you know, my favorite bird is the daggum buzzard.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it just takes me back when I was a kid, back before I started school. We lived down in this side of Huntington on old farm type. They had cows and this and that.
Mm-hmm.
And I just remember seeing them old buzzards floating around.
Yeah.
It makes you want, little kid, makes you wonder exactly how they do that.
Right.
But anyway, I've always been fascinated by that.
That's a good one. Gary, I have to tell you, I can put evil spells on people, and you're going to come back as a buzzard since it's your favorite bird. That'd be all right, huh?
Well, think about it. You hardly ever see them killed.
That's true.
I mean, they live. They can, what do you call them, scavengers?
Yeah, that's right. And they're eating venison year-round on our roadside, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, that's true. That would be pretty good. I just want to make sure I'm at that deer first. I don't want to wait 2 or 3 days, especially in June.
There you go.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, we go out, well, even now, we go out when it's you know, when it's nice, you know, we go out in a field. We got a clear cut down there, and we sit out there and just watch them. Which I may have called in a couple of times, asked about them.
Yeah.
But anyway,
cool.
But they do mate, right? I mean, they live in pairs.
Yeah, they do. In the breeding season, they do pair up, and turkey vultures and black vultures, they're typically looking for hollows or tree falls. They really like it when a big bushy tree falls to the ground, and they can crawl up under there and make a little burrow.
And didn't you say they go to abandoned houses and stuff like that?
Yes. And so since we start building stuff, and when it gets old and abandoned, like a barn or an old house or a tool shed, they'll use that too. So
there's an old house or with old barn on it, and we've seen them around it a couple of times last year.
Yeah, and that, you know, that makes sense. There's protection from the hot sun, protection from the cold rain, and so that makes sense to use that.
I guess you can watch the babies a little better too.
That's right. Yep, and you can bring those venison scraps to them. So,
yeah.
All right, Gary. Yeah. Well, we appreciate your insight on your favorite bird.
All right, you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist Cliff Shackelford, and we have a line open right now. Two lines open: 800-552-8502, 800-552-8502. David and Sean, please stay online. We've got to go to Ann from Nacogdoches next. Ann, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Well, actually, I have two comments, and then I'll follow with a question. My first comment is that I feel very lucky to have red-breasted nuthatch at my house this year.
All right.
They sound funny. They make me smile every time. They look fabulous.
Cool.
And their activity level is really fun to watch.
Yeah, they're active little guys. And are they eating the seed or are they taking them off? If you watch them, most of the time they're hauling off seed to cache it in the rough bark somewhere for later use. Have you noticed that from
I'm
your
nuthatch? I'm glad you mentioned that, because I thought I saw them tucking it in the bark, but I wasn't confident that that's what was happening.
Yeah, and so it also makes it easier for them to chisel because they don't have to use their foot. So, but sometimes they'll leave it there and come back later, and a lot of times they forget, and other birds and squirrels will find the seed for later, but it's called caching, C-A-C-H-E. And you can really see that with red-breasted nuthatches. So that's cool you've got them at your feeder.
Yes, they're really a pleasure. I'd also like to say that a $12 limited public use permit is a great thing to have, and I spent a day today at a wildlife management area looking at birds, and I just wanted to remind people that that's available and those public lands are available.
Awesome.
To enjoy them.
That's a great public service announcement, and that's for Texas WMAs. And so I don't know what the price is in Louisiana, but I'm sure it's comparable. And you're right. We have a lot of lands that are in wildlife management areas that for a few bucks you can go tromping around and see some really neat things. So thanks for reminding us about that.
Now, my question is, I have on several occasions seen goldfinch or purplefinch at my feeder with crusty, swollen eyes. And I'm not sure if it's best just to clean it or just to take it down altogether and not have a feeder. And I wondered if you had advice there.
Yeah. So what the general rule of thumb is some of that can be contagious, and that you should stop feeding, turn everything down, shut it all down. And because otherwise you've got that one bird that's not healthy and then 57 other birds that are feeding right alongside it. So you want to kind of eliminate that attraction of that Grand Central Station. Actually, that's the word I forgot to mention when who was that called? Oliver talked about his hawks in his yard. Mm-hmm. And I kept saying, I didn't say the full Grand Central Station to refer to the bustling and all the movement of all the birds. So I would say, Anne, it would be best to shut down the feeder. Hopefully that bird will move on. It'll probably end up dying. That's usually what happens to those guys, especially when the eye crusts over and they can't see anymore. That doesn't benefit a bird that is going to be flying into stuff or get picked off at the feeder. So maybe that's what Oliver's sharp-shinned hawk should eat, is one of these one of these eye conjunctivitis finches. But it is unfortunate. Not every bird, not every human is perfect and healthy, and so it's just something we have to
part of nature.
We have to recognize and appreciate.
What about scattering it widely on the ground? Would that?
Yeah, that would be probably possible? That would probably be a good solution, because at the feeder it's really tight and there's limited seating, and they're bumping into each other. And then that bird, I don't know how that stuff is spread if he bumps into the feeder. If it can, I don't know how it works. I'm not a veterinarian. But that might be a good solution, spread it out on the ground until you know, maybe that bird has left.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ann. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we have just about all lines tied up right now. But we want Sean from Kilgore and Buck from Windsor. Please stay on the line. David is up next from Nacogdoches County. David, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hello. I have two observations that you might find interesting about buzzards. I was listening to a guy talking about buzzards.
Yep.
And I live in an area where there's a whole lot of buzzards. I mean, they fly. There's hundreds of them in the sky there. And they congregate, you know, in the pine trees. And that probably the two kinds are together, the black ones and the turkey vultures.
Right.
Anyway, about a month ago, I had pneumonia, and I was walking around my property, and, you know, they're always out there, and they're always watching me and everything, and but when I got pneumonia, I noticed that they would follow me and circle me, you know? I mean, they were just, like, waiting for me to die.
You must have looked really rough with your pneumonia.
Well... it was very subtle. I mean, walked almost the same way, but I might have been slower, and I might have hunched over a little bit, right?
Yeah.
They were, I mean, you know, hundreds of them, like circling way up into the sky.
Right.
And so I just noticed that, and they would, I mean, they were directly above me, and I would walk, you know, like for two or three blocks, city blocks, you know.
Right.
And it would be right above me the whole time.
Right. Well, it sounds like you've got a roost nearby. They'll congregate at a roost. That's where they'll sleep. Of course, another place they'll congregate is at a dead animal. And so you might have had something on near the roadside. But when they're there, they're usually coming in to sleep, or they just filled up their bellies and they're looking for a place to loaf and digest. So that's a cool observation. Thanks for the call, David.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we have just about all lines tied up, but you can get in right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. It's funny, every time I go out and sun myself, the buzzards start circling around, so I don't know.
Yeah.
It's kind of scary when you think about it.
You look plump and juicy, I bet.
I guess so. All right. We've got Buck and Steve. Please stay on the line. You're on hold right now, but Sean from Kilgore, you are next. What's your question tonight?
Hey, guys. So that's funny that David actually just called in about the buzzards roosting, because mine was kind of a similar question.
Okay.
Where I work in Kilgore is kind of known for the oil industry, so we have lots of replica oil derricks around town.
Right.
And there's one specific derrick where these buzzards will congregate for whatever reason on just this one derrick.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all during the day, during the week, whenever you drive by there, they're literally just sitting there. And so my question was like, what was the reason? You know, anytime I've ever seen them, they were usually around a dead animal or something like that. But this is just literally in the middle of town, you know, where a bunch of traffic is. So that was my question, was what could they be doing there in that one specific spot?
Yeah, so they're also using those tall structures that you mentioned, or cell towers or big high KV line, utility lines. They like to just jump off and jump on without crashing through limbs. So these are really easy for a bird with big wingspan to get in and out, because there's not a lot of little limbs like there would be on a live tree. So in the absence of those structures, you'll see them using snags where only the larger limbs are still intact, and all the smaller, what we call secondary limbs and lesser have fallen off. So they're there because they're going to roost. So if it's getting close to dark, they're going to sleep there. You'll see them sleep in a little bit because, you know, if it's a high dewy morning, they're pretty wet. They got to wait till they dry off. So buzzards are usually not first to get up in the morning. Rarely are they first to get up in the morning, and that's why they got to get that do dried off of them, or if it's rained. And then the other reason is that they're there. If it's in the middle of the day, it's because they fattened up somewhere. There was a roadkill down the way. They fattened up, and they're looking for a place, again, to just hang out and digest their food. So that's cool that you've got that, Sean. I hope you're enjoying seeing that buzzard roost in Kilgore.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We go next to Buck from Windsor. Buck, you're on with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. Hey, I'm not from Windsor. I'm just driving through Windsor.
Ah, well, there you go.
I'm from Green Bay, Wisconsin. I guess I got a feel-good story. My father is 73 years old. He's an avid bird watcher, avid bird feeder. And about 10 years ago, he had a really nice place out on the bay of Green Bay. And he had all these feeders out. And there were so many native birds that came to that feeder that the extension, the university extension, came out there with their bird watching crew just to watch the birds at my dad's feeders.
Cool.
Because every single bird known to man that was in the Wisconsin area or native of that area was at that feeder at one time. Well, one year, I remember, he said, a big thing happened. And I said, well, what was that, Dad? He said, the rufous-sided towhee was at my bird feeder.
Okay.
And for some reason, and I'm not a bird person, I don't know anything about birds, he said that was a big deal for me and for the people at the university, and it was just a big deal. So can you explain that to me?
Well, if it was wintertime, that bird should have been to the south. So it was probably a big deal if it was cold winter month. And now that bird has gone through a name change, and the bird there would be now called the eastern towhee. So rufous sided is an old name. I bet you if it was wintertime, it was just an unusual overwintering bird, and that's pretty cool. So my question is your did your dad name his feeder Favre or Rogers? Huh?
You know what? You know, Favre's a traitor. So, you know what? Aaron Rodgers is kind of a prima donna. So, yeah, I think it's Bart Starr, actually.
Oh, yeah.
You're
showing your age now. I didn't think you were going to go that far back, but you bet.
That's my era.
Bart's the man.
Yeah, I'm 48, man. I went through that era.
Okay, good. That's some good football up there. Good birds, too.
Absolutely. Thanks for taking my call, guys.
Thank you, Buck. Oh,
you're welcome. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, and we've got John from Marshall and Randy from Lufkin. Please stay on the line. We've got Steve ahead of you. Steve from Bernice, you are on with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Well, I've got a couple of questions. The simple one is this: what size is the hole in a bluebird house supposed to be?
Oh gosh, I have to look that stuff up myself. What is it? 1 1/8 inch? Don't quote
me
on that.
I can't remember.
It's online.
I want to say like 1 5/8 or something.
I don't know.
Somebody gave me a birdhouse and it's got 1 1/2 inch hole in it, and I didn't think that sounded right. I can modify it, I suppose.
Yeah, but that sounds a little big. But you can go online and look that up. The blueprints. I can't remember numbers. That's tough.
The reason I'm interested in it at all right now is I'm a janitor, and we have trouble with these mud birds building their nests right there by the front door.
Uh-huh. Yeah, those are
not have that because of the manure right there by the front door and over windows and stuff.
Yeah. Okay, those mud swallows are probably barn, could be cliff swallows, and you won't have them this time of the year, so you can do all the cleanup you want. And then you want to probably try to discourage them from making nests in March, April, May, if that's an issue where you work. So they are a protected bird, and they're good neighbors to have. Remember, swallows are eating pesky insects that we would normally spray and shoo away that we don't like. So we want to have those swallows around us. So they're good neighbors to have. Thanks for the call, Steve.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we're going to go to Randy next. And John, please stay on with us. We've got to get to Randy first. Randy, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
How's everything going today?
Good, Randy. Where are you calling from?
Well, I live on the outskirts of Lufkin out in Hudson.
Okay.
you might be familiar with.
Oh, yeah. I drive through Hudson all the time, going to the big city of Groveton through Apple Springs, and they're on Highway 94. I know it well.
Oh, very well. But I've been hearing a bunch of owls.
Okay.
I mean, they're just going off.
What time of the day are you hearing it?
Probably 10
a.m., p.m.? What are we talking about?
P.m.
Okay, so we're talking at night. Because the reason I ask is we get callers that hear what they think are owls calling all day long, and they're probably Eurasian collar doves or white-winged doves. They sound like they're hooting. But if you've got them at night, the barred owls are probably what you're hearing, B-A-R-R-E-D, and they're starting to ramp up the breeding season right now. So they're pairing up, they're calling, they're bonding, they're keeping other barred owls out, and they're just very vocal right now. So it's the pre-breeding season for barred owls, Randy, and that's what you're hearing. And actually, we're going to play a hoot. Bill's queuing it up right here.
That's it?
Yeah, that's the barred owl, B-A-R-R-E-D. Do it one more time, Bill.
All right, well, if you can. Give me a second here.
Not that one.
All right, that's the call.
Yeah, let's do the hooting. Here it comes. Wait for it. Yeah. So
that's it.
Yep, that's it, Randy. That's the barred owl, and they are getting ready to make babies.
But I love them.
Yeah.
I really do. How can I protect them?
Keep your trees. Don't cut your trees down. Leave your trees up. They like woods. They like creek bottom woods, they like hardwoods. You got to leave the trees. If you turn it into pasture, say goodbye to the barred owl. All right, thanks for the call, Randy.
And you are listening to Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist. And we have one more call to go to, John from Marshall. You're on with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
I can't find my bird book, and I'm trying to identify a bird I saw. It's a breast and head were sort of a rust color, but its wings, its back were blue.
Was it just an eastern bluebird?
I'm not sure. I was just trying to.
Okay.
I can't find my bird book, and I'm trying to figure out what I saw.
Yeah, it might be just the backyard eastern bluebird. And that's something you should be able to see pretty close up. There are not a lot of birds with blue in them. So we're talking about sky blue, not a blue-gray, not a gray-blue, but a really blue that looks like, you know, the sky.
Yeah, this was when the sky is really clear, no clouds,
yeah.
No whiteness to it, the deep,
yeah.
Sort of deep blue that you see, that's the blue I saw across its back.
Right.
A little bit on the underwing, but the breast and head were sort of a rust color.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure what kind. I figured it was some sort of bluebird, but
yep.
I wasn't sure which one.
Yeah, there's three species in North America, and that's the dominant one in our listening area, the dominant one in the eastern half of the U.S., and it's called the eastern bluebird. And that's your bird, John, so thanks so much for the call.
All right.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we had one last caller. They didn't want to go online, but they wanted to ask, what are the top four or five birds by population in the Shreveport area?
So they want to know what the top three or four birds are by number that are in the city?
Population-wise, size-wise.
Oh, I mean, great-tailed grackles, there's a buku of those. European starling, there are buku of those. There's a lot of mourning doves, and in the winter, I mean, you can see a lot of American robins around here in the winter. This is a tough question. I mean, there's a lot of possibilities, and maybe those three or four will suffice.
All right. Well, thank you, Cliff, for joining us again, and we're going to get to our conservation tip to wrap up this show.
We're going to talk about garbage and recycling. Remember, we tie these into the bird we profiled. So the U.S. is the number one trash-producing country in the world at 1,600 pounds per person per year. This means that 5% of the world's people generate 40% of the world's waste. We also throw out thousands of pounds of organic waste like fruit and vegetable scraps that could instead be composted and later added to our gardens and wildscapes. Packaging in the form of wrappers, bottles, boxes, and paper represent about 65% of all household trash. Instead of just throwing these items away, try recycling in order to keep it out of the landfill, not just to save space, but to save money. On average, it costs $30 per ton to recycle trash, but $50 per ton to send it to the landfill. You might be asking yourself why garbage and recycling is this month's conservation topic. The species we profiled earlier in this episode, the ring-billed gull, sometimes visits dumpsters and landfills looking for food scraps, as do a lot of other birds and wildlife. While doing so, these animals can get trapped or injured by the debris, and they can also ingest harmful substances like plastics. Gulls and other birds don't need dumpsters and landfills to be their foraging grounds. Separate your recyclables, compost various kitchen scraps, and reduce the waste you generate on a daily basis. It may take a little extra effort on your part to do this, but it's worth it if you care about wildlife. Do it for the birds.
All right, and I want to thank you again, Cliff, for joining us for another edition of Bird Calls.
Great. Thanks, Bill. Thanks for all you do.
And you are listening, or have been listening, to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And he is also the Texas Parks and Wildlife Ornithologist for the state of Texas. And we want to thank Texas Parks and Wildlife for helping us with this program tonight. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and we are dedicating this program, this episode of Bird Calls, to Rose Shackelford, Cliff's mother, who passed away recently after a long illness, and she always encouraged his interest and love for the birds. Thank you very much, Rose, and may you rest well. Kiss the face of God. This has been Bird Calls from Red River Radio. Our producers for this show are Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford, with help tonight on our phone banks from Wally Derleth, Sheila Lawrence, and Tim Schnell. And our bird profile species tonight, the sound for that, can be found at xenocanto.org and was recorded by Paul Marvin. This month's bird photo was snapped by James Childress. The audio for tonight's program, again, will be posted here in the next hour or so on our website. And remember, if you have a photo or a sound clip of a bird you would like us to identify, you can send it to my email address at wbeckett.edu. That's wbeckett.edu. Be sure to join us for the next installment of Bird Calls. Next month, it'll be on March 26th, 2 weeks later than normal due to a scheduling conflict. And also on April 9th, we will be having our next joint episode of The Birds and the Bugs with Dr. Beverly Burden joining Cliff for a dual show, and you can call in then at that time. Our next edition of Health Matters will be this Thursday night at 6, and it's on heart health. How appropriate for Valentine's Day. You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio, and we want to thank everybody for calling in tonight and for joining us. And stay tuned. We'll be joining Radiolab here shortly.